It was carved from the earth by tectonic fury, divided by empire, and reclaimed by blood. Panama isn't just a country, it's a corridor of power, a prize fought over by kings, colonizers, drug lords, and superpowers. For centuries, outsiders controlled its destiny. But this is the story of how a nation fought to reclaim its voice through betrayal, revolution, dictatorship, and defiance. From gold routes to gunfire, from canal riots to climate battles, this is the untold saga of Panama, the land between two oceans, and the people who refuse to be a bridge for others while going nowhere themselves. Welcome to the History of the Caribbean's podcast. If you haven't already, please consider following us on your favorite podcast platform. Today, we present to you Panama, A Journey Through Time, Episode 2. Let's dive into this thrilling narrative together. Chapter 5, The Whisper of Independence. Independence doesn't arrive with drums and declarations. Not at first. It begins in silence, on the tip of a merchant's tongue, in the corner of a classroom, in the careful shuffle of contraband papers passed from one candlelit hand to another. Before flags are raised, before statues are built, revolution begins as a whisper. And in Panama, it whispered for decades before anyone dared to shout. By the end of the 18th century, the Spanish Empire was not what it once was. The gold mines of Potosí had begun to dry. The galleons that once plied the seas with impunity were harassed by pirates, privateers, and rival navies. And the once unchallenged authority of the Spanish crown was faltering, gnawed from within by corruption, and from without by a rising tide of Enlightenment thought. In Europe, the world had changed. The French Revolution had overturned centuries of monarchy. Napoleon Bonaparte had risen and fallen like a star on fire. In the Americas, Haitian slaves had overthrown their masters and declared a black republic. And in the 13 colonies to the north, revolution had already rewritten the map. The idea that kings were not divine and that people had a right to self-govern was no longer blasphemy. It was contagious. Panama, strategically vital but culturally peripheral, was listening. The city of Panama, now firmly established at Casco Antiguo, had grown into a cosmopolitan hub. Merchants from Cartagena, Lima, Seville, Port-au-Prince, and even Jamaica mingled in its plazas. The aristocratic Criollo families, those born in the Americas but of Spanish blood, controlled trade and wealth but were denied access to real power. High positions in government, church, and military remained the exclusive domain of peninsulars, Spaniards born in Europe. Resentment brewed beneath layers of protocol and powdered wigs. Some Criollos studied abroad in Spain and returned with dangerous ideas. They brought books by Voltaire, Rousseau, Locke, often hidden behind false covers. Others joined secret societies, Masonic lodges, and salons where they discussed liberty and reason over glasses of wine and maps of imaginary republics. Even priests, once enforcers of order, began to question the morality of a monarchy that sanctioned slavery and denied rights to the people it claimed to protect. But if the Criollos dreamed of freedom, the mestizos, indigenous, and Afro-Panamanians lived in a different reality. To them, the Spanish crown was not just a distant authority. It was the system that had enslaved their ancestors, erased their gods, and extracted their labor for centuries. The idea of independence meant different things to different people. For the elite, it often meant more power within the same hierarchy. For the poor, it meant the possibility, however remote, of dignity. Yet even in this atmosphere of unrest, Panama was cautious. Unlike Mexico or Venezuela, where revolts turned bloody and widespread, Panama's position as a trade hub made its leaders wary of disruption. Merchants feared economic collapse. Bishops feared spiritual anarchy. And many simply doubted that independence could ever truly work in a country so fragmented by race, class, and geography. But the cracks kept spreading. In 1808, Napoleon invaded Spain and forced King Ferdinand VII to abdicate. In his place, Napoleon installed his brother Joseph Bonaparte on the throne. Across the Spanish colonies, a wave of disbelief and fury followed. Many loyalists claimed allegiance to the true king in exile, while others saw the chaos as an opportunity to break free entirely. In 1810, revolutionary governments sprang up across Latin America. Simón Bolívar rose in Venezuela. José de San Martín led armies through Argentina and Chile. Independence movements gained traction in Colombia, Peru, Ecuador, and beyond. Panama, positioned in the middle of it all, could not ignore the momentum forever. That same year, Criollo leaders in Panama formed a short-lived autonomous junta. Inspired by events in Bogota and Caracas, they argued for the right to self-rule in the absence of a legitimate Spanish monarch. But the Spanish colonial authorities responded quickly. The junta was dismantled, its members arrested or exiled. The whisper had grown too loud, too soon. Still, it never truly faded. Throughout the 1810s, Panama remained a place of secret loyalties and shifting alliances. Some towns, especially in the interior, harbored sympathies for independence, but lacked the weapons or leadership to act. Others remained deeply loyal to Spain, not out of love, but fear. Civil war loomed like a storm just beyond the horizon. And then came Bolívar. By 1821, Bolívar's armies had begun to liberate northern South America with breathtaking speed. Having already helped free Venezuela and Colombia, his eyes turned toward consolidating the newly independent territories into a single nation, a grand union he called Gran Colombia. The idea was bold, a federation of republics, united in language, law, and purpose, stretching from the Caribbean to the Andes. In Panama, the balance shifted rapidly. By November 1821, independence was no longer a fantasy. Spain's grip on the Americas was crumbling. Troops were deserting. Taxes were unpayable. Even some Spanish officials quietly conceded that the end was near. The tipping point came not with war, but with strategy. On November 28, 1821, after a series of careful negotiations and behind-the-scenes alliances, the Cabildo Abierto, a public town hall, was convened in Panama City. There, local leaders declared their independence from Spain. But they also made a crucial decision. Instead of forming an autonomous republic, Panama would immediately join Gran Colombia under Bolívar's vision. The declaration was elegant, calculated, and bloodless. No shots were fired. No palaces were burned. No heads rolled in the plaza. But beneath the surface, the decision was fraught with complexity. To many Panamanians, especially the Criollos, joining Gran Colombia felt like a safeguard against chaos. The new republic would provide protection, unity, and access to Bolívar's growing international influence. But others saw it differently. To the indigenous and Afro-descendant populations, the new arrangement looked suspiciously like the old one: new flags, same hierarchy, freedom for the few, order for the many. And so, Panama entered its next era, not as a fully free nation, but as a region bound to a larger experiment. Gran Colombia was ambitious, but fragile. Deep divisions soon surfaced. Regional rivalries, personal egos, and ideological conflicts tore at the seams. Bolívar's vision of a unified northern South America began to unravel almost as quickly as it had come together. By 1831, Gran Colombia collapsed under its own weight. Venezuela and Ecuador broke away. What remained, Colombia and Panama, became known as the Republic of New Granada. Once again, Panama was part of someone else's republic. Once again, the decisions about its future were made far from its soil. And yet, something had changed. Independence, however incomplete, had planted a seed. A question: what does it mean to be Panamanian? Not Spanish, not Colombian, not merely a port or a path, but a people, a place, a soul. In the decades that followed, Panama would struggle to answer that question. The canal would rise. Empires would return. Revolutions would come and go. But on that quiet morning in November of 1821, when Criollos gathered in Panama City and claimed their place in the tide of history, the whisper finally became a word: Libertad. And even though it came wrapped in compromise, even though it led not to self-rule, but to another tether, it was, at last, the start of something. The first breath of a nation not yet born. Chapter 6, The Railroad That Changed the World. It began with a dream. A thin line of iron crossing a continent. A path to fortune. A shortcut through nature's most stubborn barrier. But dreams have costs. And for Panama, the cost would be steep, measured in blood, sweat, disease, and sovereignty. The first transcontinental railroad did not cross the United States. It crossed the jungle. It crossed Panama. And it changed the world, not just where it went, but who would come to own it. By the mid-19th century, Panama was a country in name, but not in power. Still part of New Granada, the successor state to Gran Colombia, it was governed from Bogota, a city hundreds of mountainous miles away, separated by geography and indifference. The central government barely maintained a presence in Panama, collecting taxes and issuing decrees from afar, while leaving local elites to handle day-to-day governance. For most Panamanians, Bogota was a ghostly landlord, ever demanding but never present. But beyond the borders of the isthmus, something extraordinary was happening. In 1848, gold was discovered in California. Almost overnight, thousands of would-be miners, merchants, and fortune seekers, most from the eastern United States, began a mad rush to the West Coast. But there was a problem. There was no easy way to get there. The overland route across North America was brutal, plagued by deserts, mountains, and native resistance. The sea route around Cape Horn took 6 months and passed through treacherous waters. And so, all eyes turned to Panama, the narrowest point in the Americas, a place where one could sail from New York or New Orleans, disembark on the Caribbean side, cross the isthmus by land, and catch another ship to San Francisco. The logic was undeniable. All it needed was infrastructure. All it needed was a railroad. In 1850, an American company was chartered with a bold mission: to build the first transcontinental railroad in the world across the Isthmus of Panama. It would run from Colon, then called Aspinwall, on the Caribbean coast, to Panama City on the Pacific, some 47 miles of track through some of the most inhospitable terrain on the planet. The company was called the Panama Railroad Company, and it was backed by powerful investors in New York and Boston. But it would be Panama and its people who would pay the price. Construction began that same year. At first, the American engineers were confident. They had capital, machinery, and ambition. What they didn't have was experience building in tropical rainforest. The jungle, they quickly discovered, was not just vegetation, it was resistance incarnate. The isthmus fought back with all its might. Torrential rains washed away tracks. Swamps swallowed men whole. Mosquitoes delivered malaria and yellow fever with every bite. The sun boiled brains. The rivers carried disease. Work slowed, then stopped, then started again. And so the company did what many empires had done before. It turned to desperate labor. The workforce for the Panama Railroad became one of the most diverse and tragic ever assembled. Men arrived from Ireland, Germany, China, Jamaica, Barbados, and across Latin America. Many came voluntarily. Others were tricked, coerced, or forced. It is estimated that over 50,000 men worked on the line during its construction, and that between 5,000 and 10,000 of them died. Some died from accidents, buried in mudslides, crushed by equipment, drowned in sudden floods. But most died from disease, especially cholera, yellow fever, and malaria. There were no antibiotics, no effective medical protocols. A man might wake up with a fever and be dead by nightfall, buried in a shallow grave by sunrise. The railroad workers called it the Fever Road. The bodies piled up so quickly that laborers were sometimes buried beneath the tracks themselves, wrapped in tarps and covered in gravel, the trains rolling over their bones. The jungle, as ever, swallowed them with indifference. Despite the human toll, the project continued. By 1855, the Panama Railroad was completed 2 years ahead of schedule, at a cost of over $8 million, a staggering sum for the time, and at an incalculable human price. The first locomotive crossed from ocean to ocean in under 3 hours. The age of steam had triumphed over nature, or so the investors believed. To the outside world, it was a marvel. It became the most expensive railroad per mile ever constructed up to that point, and also the most lucrative. Suddenly, Panama was the vital artery of the Western Hemisphere. In the decade that followed, hundreds of thousands of people crossed the isthmus via the railroad, gold seekers, diplomats, missionaries, and soldiers. The United States military used it to move troops during the Civil War. Merchants used it to move goods faster than ever before. A journey that once took months now took days. But while foreign fortune soared, Panama itself remained mired in inequality and instability. The railroad company was American-owned. Its profits flowed north. The Panamanian people, particularly the Afro-Caribbean and indigenous populations, were locked out of the wealth their land was generating. Wages were low. Conditions were brutal. The American presence on the isthmus grew more permanent, more entitled, and more invasive. The town of Colon, which had sprung up around the railroad's Caribbean terminus, became a kind of extraterritorial enclave. It was filled with American hotels, American bars, and American soldiers. Local laws bent to the needs of foreign capital. Race hierarchies already entrenched in colonial Panama became even more rigid, particularly between white Americans and Afro-Caribbean workers. It didn't take long for resentment to boil over. In 1856, tensions erupted into violence. A dispute between a white American traveler and a local vendor in Panama City's train station turned into a riot. Fueled by anger over decades of mistreatment and inequality, Panamanians attacked American businesses and personnel. The Americans retaliated with armed force. Dozens died. The event became known as the Watermelon War, a dismissive name for what was, in truth, an uprising against foreign exploitation. The United States responded by invoking the Malarino-Bidlack Treaty, signed in 1846 with New Granada, which granted the U.S. the right to intervene militarily in Panama to protect transit routes. Within days, U.S. Marines landed in Panama City, ostensibly to restore order, but effectively to establish a precedent. America would now be the protector of Panamanian transit. It was a chilling foreshadowing. The railroad had given Panama global importance, but at a steep cost to its autonomy. The isthmus was no longer just a path. It was an object, a corridor to be guarded, owned, and if necessary, occupied. For Panamanians, the railroad was a paradox. It brought modernization and devastation, prosperity and dependency. It connected them to the world while tightening foreign control. It was a marvel of engineering and a monument to suffering. And yet, beneath the political maneuvering and economic extraction, something else had begun to take root, a national consciousness. Panamanians, tired of being a footnote in someone else's story, began to see themselves not just as residents of a place, but as a people. They watched as their land was used, their labor exploited, their rights trampled. And slowly, they began to ask, if we are so vital to the world, why are we not in charge of our own destiny? The railroad, for all its metal and might, could not answer that question. But it had set the stage for those who would. In the decades to come, it would become clear. Whoever controlled Panama's corridor, be it rail or canal, would control a vital artery of the world. And whoever controlled Panama itself would control the future of empires. Chapter 7. Dreams Drenched in Mud. The French Canal Disaster. They came not with swords or cannons, but with blueprints, contracts, and champagne. They came not as conquerors, but as visionaries. They came to carve through a continent, to reshape oceans, to write history with dynamite and ambition. But the jungle, ancient and patient, watched them come. And then it began to swallow them whole. By the 1870s, the idea of building a canal through Panama had become an obsession. The narrowest point in the Americas, the isthmus, had been a global choke point for centuries. Every ship that passed from Atlantic to Pacific had to make the long journey around Cape Horn, battling Antarctic waters, storms, and time. The Panama Railroad had proven that transit across the isthmus could be lucrative. But a canal? That would change the world. Enter Ferdinand de Lesseps. To the European world, de Lesseps was a hero. The man who had overseen the successful construction of the Suez Canal in Egypt, a straight, sea-level channel linking the Mediterranean and Red Seas, had become a symbol of engineering glory. He was hailed as Le Grand Français, the man who had defeated the desert and bridged empires. His confidence was boundless. His reputation, unassailable. When he turned his eyes to Panama, investors lined up to give him money. How could he fail? In 1879, de Lesseps and his backers formed the Compagnie Universelle du Canal Interocéanique de Panama. They launched a public stock offering, promising a project of grand proportions. A sea-level canal, just like the Suez, would be cut through the heart of Panama. It would cost 1.2 billion francs and take roughly 6 to 8 years. There was no serious geological study, no tropical medicine expertise, no humility. There was only confidence. Parisian newspapers printed triumphant headlines. Models of the canal were displayed in department stores. Wealthy citizens, teachers, shopkeepers, widows invested their life savings. De Lesseps toured like a celebrity. He declared Panama would become a garden for civilization, a masterpiece of human will over nature. But nature in Panama is not easily conquered. The land was not like Egypt. There were no flat deserts here, no dry sand. Panama was a snarling beast of mountains, rivers, swamps, and tropical storms. The Culebra Cut, the highest point along the route, would require slicing through solid rock hundreds of feet deep. The rivers refused to cooperate, flooding work sites at random. Landslides swept away months of progress in seconds. And then came the true enemy, disease. The mosquitoes arrived like executioners. At first, no one understood what was killing the men. Yellow fever, malaria, dysentery, and typhoid decimated the workforce. The French doctors believed in miasma, the theory that disease was spread by bad air. So they built hospitals near swamps, thinking the moist air would aid recovery. Instead, it sealed the workers' fate. Men collapsed by the dozens, then hundreds. Some screamed in fevered hallucinations. Others bled from the eyes, vomited black bile, and died within hours. The bodies were stacked in makeshift morgues and buried in shallow graves. Many were simply lost to the mud. It is estimated that more than 22,000 workers died during the French Canal effort. Some say the number is far higher. The workers came from everywhere: Martinique, Guadeloupe, Haiti, Barbados, India, China, Colombia, France, enticed by promises of decent wages and advancement. Most found only death, despair, and disease. Families were separated. Communities were wiped out. Entire ships of laborers arrived healthy and vanished within months. De Lesseps refused to alter course. Even as engineers begged for a switch to a lock-based design, a more realistic approach given the elevation of the terrain, de Lesseps clung to his sea-level vision. He dismissed warnings. He pressured managers to downplay death rates. He hired his son, Charles, to oversee logistics despite his lack of qualifications. And he assured investors that everything was under control. The press began to report otherwise. Rumors of mass graves and financial mismanagement circulated in European papers. Skeptics questioned where the money was going. Workers described appalling conditions. Engineers left the project, calling it cursed. But de Lesseps dismissed criticism. He doubled down, announcing a revised timeline and asking for more funds. Then the collapse began. In 1889, the Compagnie Universelle declared bankruptcy. The canal was incomplete, only about 40% finished, and riddled with failure. Investors across France were ruined. Over 800,000 people had put money into the project, and many lost everything. The government launched an inquiry. Charges of fraud, embezzlement, and corruption surfaced. The scandal rocked France. It was one of the largest financial disasters in history. Politicians were implicated. Bankers were arrested. Public outrage surged. The de Lesseps name, once synonymous with triumph, became a symbol of hubris. Ferdinand and Charles de Lesseps were put on trial, convicted of fraud, and sentenced to prison, though the elder de Lesseps, aged and sick, never served time. But the real tragedy wasn't financial. It was human. In Panama, the aftermath was a landscape of ghosts. Half-built structures rusted in the rain. Tools lay abandoned in the mud. The jungle crept over rail lines and excavated pits. Fever hospitals became graveyards. The canal route itself became a haunted corridor, lined with the unmarked remains of thousands who had come chasing a promise and found only death. Local Panamanians watched it all unfold. Many had hoped the French presence would bring prosperity. Instead, they saw their land carved apart and their people consigned to misery. The foreign engineers came and went. The money came and vanished. And Panama, once again, was left holding the consequences of someone else's dream. Yet even amid the failure, something had shifted. The very idea of a canal, once a fantasy, had become a physical reality, albeit incomplete. Earth had been moved. Terrain had been surveyed. The notion of connecting oceans was no longer myth. It was infrastructure waiting to be finished. And the world noticed. In the ruins of the French effort, other powers saw opportunity. Chief among them, the United States. American newspapers covered the French collapse with a mix of glee and ambition. Business leaders saw potential. Politicians saw strategy. And the U.S. military saw a future in which naval power could flow between oceans in a matter of hours. But before they could act, they had to wait. Wait for the ruins to settle. Wait for the scandal to fade. Wait for the right moment. In the meantime, Panama lingered in limbo. By the 1890s, Panama was still technically part of Colombia, though the isthmus remained culturally and economically distinct. Panamanians had begun to see their region as something separate, something overlooked, exploited, and underappreciated. The failure of the French had laid bare a fundamental truth. Foreign powers would come for Panama's geography, but never its people. And the people were watching. They watched the rusted tools in the jungle. They watched the rising interest of the United States. They watched as Colombia failed to invest, failed to understand, failed to care. And they began to dream, not of gold or railroads or even canals, but of control, of self-determination, of a Panama run by Panamanians. The mud had swallowed the French dream, but in its place, a seed had been planted. And in the next chapter, the Americans would come to claim it. Chapter 8, A Deal with the Devil, U.S. Intervention and Canal Creation. Independence, when it came, wasn't wrapped in rebellion or born in bloodshed. It came wrapped in a treaty Panama didn't write, on a warship Panama didn't summon, to protect a canal Panama would not control. It came fast. It came calculated. It came in the shadow of another empire's ambition. And for better or worse, it changed everything. By the dawn of the 20th century, Panama was at a crossroads, literally and politically. Still tethered to Colombia, Panama had long been treated as a peripheral province, too far from Bogota and too important to ignore. Its strategic location had made it both a crown jewel and a neglected outpost. The failed French canal effort, abandoned in the 1880s and choked by jungle and scandal, had left behind a skeleton of half-dug ditches and rusting machinery. But to global powers, it had also left behind potential, the kind that nations are willing to betray for. No power hungered for that potential more than the United States. In the wake of the Spanish-American War, 1898, the U.S. had emerged as an imperial force with overseas colonies, a growing navy, and a newfound belief in its destiny to dominate the Western Hemisphere. President Theodore Roosevelt, brash and expansionist, believed the United States not only could, but should build and control a canal in Central America. To him, the idea was both strategic and sacred. There were two possible routes, Nicaragua and Panama. Nicaragua had wider valleys and fewer technical challenges, but Panama, despite its jungle and mountain spine, was shorter. More importantly, the French had already done some of the work. The remains of the Compagnie Nouvelle du Canal de Panama still owned the rights to the failed French project. They were eager to sell. The Americans were eager to buy. In 1902, after heavy lobbying and even falsified maps exaggerating Nicaragua's volcanic dangers, Congress voted in favor of the Panama route. Negotiations began between the U.S. and Colombia, which technically still held sovereignty over the isthmus. The resulting proposal was known as the Hay-Herrin Treaty, under which the U.S. would pay Colombia $10 million up front and an annual lease for control of a 6-mile-wide canal zone. But in August 1903, The Colombian Senate rejected the treaty, fearing that the deal sold off too much land for too little compensation. To Roosevelt, this was more than a disappointment. It was a challenge. He had already committed politically to the canal. Backing down would mean humiliation. Waiting would mean delay. And so, in the dark corridors of diplomacy, a new plan emerged. One that would change Panama's fate forever. The conspiracy for independence. The United States didn't declare war. It didn't negotiate again. Instead, it plotted. In September and October of 1903, Roosevelt's administration made quiet contact with Panamanian separatists, many of them wealthy elites in Panama City, frustrated by Colombia's centralism. These men, including Manuel Amador Guerrero, Panama's former treasurer, saw an opportunity. With U.S. support, they could break from Bogota and form a sovereign republic. On November 2, 1903, a U.S. warship, the USS Nashville, arrived off the coast of Colón. Officially, it was there to protect American interests. Unofficially, it was there to ensure the success of a rebellion that hadn't yet happened. The message was clear. Colombia would not be allowed to move troops through the isthmus. The next day, November 3rd, the Panamanian independence movement launched its bloodless coup. There were no armies, no major battles, no firefights in the streets. The Colombian garrison in Panama, isolated, outnumbered, and without reinforcements, surrendered without a shot. The Republic of Panama was declared. 3 days later, on November 6th, the United States became the first nation to recognize Panama's independence. And 15 days after that, on November 18th, the newly minted Republic of Panama signed the Hay-Bunavarilla Treaty with the United States, a treaty that gave the U.S. perpetual control of a 10-mile-wide canal zone. Here's the catch. No Panamanian actually negotiated the treaty. It was signed in Washington, D.C., by Philippe Bunavarilla, a French engineer and lobbyist who hadn't lived in Panama for almost two decades. He was acting as Panama's ambassador, without ever having set foot in the new republic as a citizen. He signed away sovereignty in exchange for U.S. protection and his own financial interests. For Roosevelt, it was a triumph. He would later boast, "I took the isthmus, started the canal, and then left Congress not to debate the canal, but to debate me." To many Americans, it was bold statecraft. To many Panamanians, it was a deal with the devil. Construction begins, America's iron hand. By 1904, the United States had full control of the canal zone, which operated as an autonomous enclave under U.S. military and administrative rule. The Isthmian Canal Commission, led by John Stevens and later by George Washington Goethals, took over what the French had failed to build. But this time, they came with better engineering and something the French had lacked, medical science. Thanks to the work of Dr. William Gorgas, who built on research by Carlos Finley and Walter Reed, the Americans understood that mosquitoes were the true carriers of yellow fever and malaria. Gorgas instituted a massive public health campaign, draining swamps, fumigating homes, distributing mosquito netting, and installing sewage systems. Death rates plummeted, but the labor system was still harsh and racially divided. The workforce was split into gold roll and silver roll employees. Gold roll workers, mainly white Americans and Europeans, received high pay, air-conditioned housing, and access to exclusive services. Silver roll workers, mostly black laborers from the Caribbean, particularly Barbados and Jamaica, received lower wages, inferior housing, and brutal working conditions. Caribbean laborers were the backbone of the project, digging, blasting, hauling, but were denied dignity. They were restricted in movement, segregated in housing, and excluded from social services. Their deaths went undercounted, their names unrecorded, and yet they built the canal. The canal takes shape. The U.S. opted for a lock-based canal rather than a sea-level one. The engineering involved constructing the massive Gatun Dam, creating Lake Gatun, and building three sets of locks to lift ships over the spine of Panama and lower them again. It was an enormous, years-long undertaking involving dynamite, dredging, rail transport, and engineering ingenuity on a scale never before attempted. By 1914, the Panama Canal was complete, open to world commerce in the same month World War I erupted in Europe. ships could now cross from Atlantic to Pacific in a matter of hours. Global trade would never be the same. The U.S. Navy could move between oceans in days, not months. Panama was now home to one of the most important pieces of infrastructure on Earth. But what did Panama get? It got a foreign-controlled canal zone running through the heart of its territory, off-limits to Panamanians, patrolled by American troops, governed by American laws. It got economic dependence on U.S. wages. It got the illusion of independence without the machinery of sovereignty. It got a scar. Reverberations of the deal. In the decades that followed, the Hay-Bunavarilla Treaty became a source of national shame and political fury for Panamanians. It was viewed as a betrayal engineered by outsiders, enforced by foreign troops, and exploited for imperial gain. Generations of Panamanians grew up in the shadow of the Canal Zone, a place within their country that belonged to someone else. American flags flew over American schools in the zone. Roads and towns were named after American presidents. Panamanians were subject to searches, restrictions, and surveillance when crossing into what was technically their own territory. But resistance was coming, quiet at first, then loud. By the mid-20th century, nationalism surged. Panamanians began to demand control over the canal, and with it, their future. Protests turned into riots. Speeches became movements. And the deal with the devil, made in 1903, would one day be undone. But for now, the ink had dried. The ships were sailing. And Panama, newly independent, found itself the host of a foreign empire, on its own soil. The canal had been built, but the cost had only begun to be paid.